The story that has captivated this country, a story with unanswered questions and red flags too numerous to count. Micah Miller, the pastor's wife from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, whose death was exclusively reported by this media outlet over a week ago. Her story has exploded into the public consciousness. Folks, this is one of the biggest stories we've ever covered. And this week, we're going to dive into the mystery surrounding her death. I'm going to sit down with Jen Wood, who has been digging deep into this story, and Andy Fancher, who was on the ground in Myrtle Beach as this story unfolded. We're going to walk you through every facet of this case, including a lot of those unanswered questions. Finally, I'm going to update you on an issue that's been very near and dear to the hearts of our audience from the beginning, the issue of judicial reform. Where does it stand in South Carolina? We're going to let you know about all of that and more heading your way on The Week in Review. All right, so we're starting this week, obviously, with the story of Micah Miller. This is a case that has attracted international attention to South Carolina again. It involves the mysterious death of a beautiful pastor's wife up in a state park in North Carolina, Saturday, April 27 of this year. Now, the lead up to this story, we have been researching extensively. And the fallout from it, we have been tracking religiously. It has been just one of the biggest stories we've ever covered. And the interest level, the incoming, the tips, all of it has just been overwhelming. But we want to start with where the story started for us, which is a video of J.P. Miller, husband of the late Micah Miller, announcing her death in a bizarre manner at the Solid Rocket Market Common Church service on April 28th, the day after she died. Let's take a look at that bizarre announcement that started this whole story. Let's take a look.
We're not going to do an altar call today. Instead, I'm going to have you stand up and I'm going to make an announcement. And after the announcement, I'm going to ask that you you leave church quietly and don't talk about the announcement here in the building, please, if you can. So y'all can stand to your feet. Before I make the announcement, I also want to say that my request to you is that you will continue to come to church and serve and give for the next, little bit. Because I'm taking a little bit of a break, and I don't want to have to worry about the church. My break may be a few days, a few weeks, I don't know. I got a call late last night. My wife has passed away. And yeah, it was self-induced, and it was up in North Carolina. And we're going to have a funeral for her next Sunday here at 3 p.m. And so it's all I can, I'm just kind of going on adrenaline right now. So y'all pray for me and my kids and everybody. And y'all knew that she wasn't well mentally, and that she needed her medicine that was hard to get to her. And so I'm sure there'll be more details to come, but just keep our family in your prayers. And I'm going to let Pastor Randall, my bishop, he can pray. I'll get him a microphone, he'll pray out. And if you have anything you want to share as well, I appreciate it.
Come on, let's pray.
So in the aftermath of this announcement, all hell broke loose. And I'm joined now by Jen Wood as we try to figure out exactly what happened to Micah Miller, what led up to this still, I think, unresolved death. I would call it that, Jen, wouldn't you?
Yes, absolutely, unresolved death.
I mean, just so many questions, right?
A lot of questions. And, the tips on this one started flooding in almost immediately. And when I say flooding, I mean flooding, which is always a good thing. I love getting tips. I love, when people say there's something not right here, here's some information I might have. But it was, for me, unprecedented, even after covering the Murdaugh case. And Micah Miller, her months leading up to her death, whatever caused it, were tremendously hard to read about. We did all of our regular FOIA requests because we were told that there was a lot going on in the relationship between her and her estranged husband in the months leading up to her death, including a recent divorce filing. So yeah, it's definitely a very complicated story. It gets into a lot of, a lot of history with his father, who was also a pastor. So a lot of, religious overtones. It's fascinating and very sad.
Jim, before we get into the run-up, which you've done amazing research, putting all those pieces together for our audience, you did a great story this past week on some of the things that Micah Miller told friends in the days and weeks prior to her death. But before we get to that narrative, I want to start with what police have revealed. I want to start with what we know about the investigation. And clearly there are a lot of questions and a lot of red flags about some of these conclusions. But let's start first with what we know, official conclusions from the medical examiner in North Carolina and from the Robeson County Sheriff's Office. What do we know so far officially from law enforcement about her death?
So this week, the Robeson County Sheriff's Office released the what I guess they're calling the results of their investigation. They've concluded that her death was by suicide, and step by step walked the public through how they came to that conclusion. According to their investigation, Micah Miller left her home around 11:38 a.m. in Myrtle Beach. She was observed going into a pawn shop at 12:13 p.m. Just 20 minutes later, she leaves the pawn shop after purchasing a gun, and she drives up to, after searching for state parks near me, drives up to the Lumbee River State Park in North Carolina. And she's spotted at a convenience store on the way up getting a drink at 1:27 p.m. And at 2:54 p.m., she called 911 and informed them that she was about to
Jen, kill herself. We've actually got that call. Let's play that 911 call. Let folks hear it. We posted it to our website earlier this week. A lot of folks have listened to it. Let's listen to this call real quick. It's only a little over 2 minutes. Let's take a quick listen to Micah Miller's call, allegedly Micah Miller's call, to the dispatch up there in Robeson County, North Carolina.
Robeson County 911, what's the address of your emergency?
Hi, are you able to trace the location of my phone?
You don't know where you're at?
A national park.
What's the phone number you're calling me from?
843-655-5242.
Where's the park located at?
In Bear Bluff. I have my location on, I think, on my phone. Find my phone is on. I just did my share my location.
Okay, I'm showing. Hold on 1 second. I don't think you are in Robeson County. Are you at the Lumbee River State Park?
Yeah, that's where I am.
Okay. Tell me what's happened.
I'm about to kill myself, and I just want my family to know where to find me.
Okay, ma'am. Just listen to what I'm saying, okay? Let me make sure I got the exact location where you're at, okay? Just 1 minute.
All right, Jen, so we've got the 911 call as well. What happens next?
Police arrive. They run into a fisherman who said he had heard someone sobbing and then a gunshot and then found her purse with her identification in it.
Mm.
So to them, you know, one of the other things they obviously investigated was the whereabouts of her estranged husband, J.P. Miller. And according to them, they have him, they have a witness putting him at a sporting event in Charleston in his vehicle at 2:22 p.m. on a flock camera, not near the state park.
So we've got the official narrative. It's laid out. Case closed as far as law enforcement is concerned. But before we start looking into this conclusion, I want to start now to go into what you were talking about earlier about the weeks, the months leading up to April 27. What was going on in Micah Miller's life? What was she telling friends and family about her relationship, Jen?
So I've spoken to a number of her close friends and, you know, Callie Lyons and I did a ton of FOIAs, and we started getting back incident reports that aligned very closely with what her close friends told me, which I think was very interesting. But in, you know, Micah had tried to leave her husband in September. They reconciled in, I believe, October. And then it sounds like in February, he had her involuntarily committed to the Waccamaw Mental Health Facility on February 8th. She was there for 2 days. She was discharged on February 10th. But when she left, the staff told her that her husband had come and taken her keys, her identification, her purse, everything that she needed. So she had basically nothing. She went and stayed with a friend and filed a police report to try to get that car back. She needed it to get to her new job. She was trying to start a new life.
Well, and that wasn't the only thing that she told friends and family her husband did. Jen, walk us through the allegation that she made that her husband had apparently, dug through her devices, through her belongings, what was the goal there of that alleged action?
According to her friends, now this isn't documented in any official documents, but according to her friends, she had been gathering evidence to prepare to file for divorce again, because the last divorce she had reconciled with them, that was off the table. So she had been gathering evidence of what her friends said, you know, were multiple affairs, financial misdeeds through the church funds, you know, just ton, like even alleged crimes within the church. I've not substantiated that, but that's what they said the goal was in having her admitted, so that she wasn't able to stop him from getting her things.
Well, and we know he went through the phone because, Jen, isn't there a sermon clip? Walk us through this clip you're about to show us.
So this clip was from a sermon that he gave shortly after, I think it was February 25th, I don't remember the exact date, shortly after she was discharged, about him going through her phone and what he found.
Let's take a look.
Only he can really heal a heart, okay? So here's four things that happens when your heart is corroded and you don't even know it. The first thing is this, is you begin to gossip and speak negatively, especially of the person that did you wrong. The very person that did you wrong, you want to talk about them and just talk. And there's a really weird idea that a lot of women have. It's so weird that women have this. Christian women think, well, I need somebody to talk to about these people that hurt me. I need somebody to talk to. Oh, you just need somebody to talk to. Just go find somebody to talk to. Okay, let me give you that person's name. That person's name is Jesus, Jesus. Okay, that's who you go and talk to. Now, if you want to talk about your own problems, the Bible says confess your own faults one to another, then you can be healed. But if you're going to talk about somebody else, that's a demon actually right there. When my wife went in the hospital, you know, I looked at her phone and I counted over the past 2 years, 18 people who had texted her and said, if you ever want to talk about your husband, you can talk to me and say anything and I'll keep it confidential. Why the heck does somebody want to hear what somebody else says about their spouse? And two of those 18 were men. I thought, I thought, you know, Mark Cassaday, he's one of our elders here, and Jackie, she oversees our New Testament discipleship. Could you see Mark calling another woman and saying, you know what, I just want to tell you some things about my wife I don't like? Or could you see Jackie calling a woman or a man, either one? No, if someone wants to call you and say bad things about somebody else, that's a demon talking to you.
All right, so Jen, this is, again, another pretty clear red flag here. And also we want to add that in the days after her death, J.P. Miller went to Micah Miller's home to retrieve belongings. This was April 30th, 3 days after her death. There's actually a police report tied to that related to some complaints about him being there. But Jen, let me ask you this question. We're starting to put together this picture, and again, the allegations that Micah Miller's friends have made, they are consistent with allegations made by her family members in court documents filed shortly after her death, seeking to protect her estate. Very similar, manipulation, controlling, stalking, harassing, all of these things. Jen, let me ask you this. You've looked at these incident reports. You've followed, the tracking devices being placed on her vehicle, a device which flattened one of her tires, apparently. What in the hell's going on here, Jen?
Right. She reported two times that a razor blade had been found in her tire. One time she took her tire to the dealership to get it repaired. And while they were repairing the tire, they found a tracking device on her vehicle. So she called law enforcement. They came out. While they were there, he called. And there's now video they released on News Nation of him showing up there. It's just, I mean, obviously there was an active pattern of stalking, and given what, given his showing up, it seems very validated to me.
Yeah. Now, Jim, we talked earlier about the police investigation into this death, and obviously we heard the 911 call. We saw all of this timeline information and corresponding photographs and surveillance videos, and it all initially, anyway, seemed to add up, but we started digging through this. We started asking questions. I know a lot of your sources, folks all over social media, have been asking questions. But, Jen, how confident are you in this official law enforcement narrative based on some of the holes we're already seeing poked through that official story? What's your level of confidence?
So this one has been very, I'm trying to take the information as it comes, very fact-based, but I have ebbed and flowed on my opinion. And right now I am not confident in the investigation as I look at, what they've released, what they haven't released. I still have a lot of questions. And I go back to the affidavit that her sister and her brother, they filed with that probate court filing. So they filed to be special administrator over Micah's estate because she was married. That would be typically her husband, but they were estranged. So they're filing that so that, half of the marital assets, in the process of the divorce should have gone to her if it went through. So they filed that to protect those assets and also to be able to get a hold of health records on her behalf.
Well, what struck you in that filing?
So that affidavit, her sister said that Micah had told her that if I die, JP did it. He will shoot me in the head if that happens. And I spoke to one of her very close friends who stayed with her after she left JP in the winter. And she said the same thing. She said, Micah said, JP is going to kill me. He's going to shoot me in the head. He's going to make it look like suicide. I'm scared for my life.
Wow.
So, I go to that, I look at that. I look at two different people, one in a sworn statement, one, a very close friend, along with the holes I'm seeing in the investigation. And I have so many questions still.
Absolutely. Well, and as we pivot now, we're going to bring in Andy Fancher here in just a minute. But you and Andy, by the way, was in Myrtle Beach for the memorial service for Micah Miller, not the one at the church where her family members were apparently excluded from, but the one that was held on the beach. We're going to talk to Andy about what he saw in just a second here. But Jim, before you go, I wanted to just get a quick update. You, Andy, and some other friends of ours, we're going to be taking a very detailed look at the final hours of Micah Miller's life. We're going to be going back to Myrtle Beach. We're going to be driving that path up to the Lumber River State Park there in North Carolina. We're going to retrace her steps. again in these last hours to try and see exactly whether or not that police report that we've been talking about, whether or not that law enforcement narrative is going to hold up to further investigative scrutiny. Jen, walk us through a little bit about the plans for this coming week and our continued investigation into this case.
Of course. I'll let Andy go into a lot of detail, but, you know, I have questions about, you know, the time frame. It's very, very tight from what I am told, you know, from getting from Micah to have gotten from point A to point B to point C. That the timeline's very tight. I would like to see that for myself. So yeah, I mean, we're going to interview some individuals that have agreed to speak with us. We've got some people close to the investigation that have agreed to, you know, help us along. I think it's going to be a fascinating look at, Michael's final day. I'm hoping to get some insight, a little better insight into the investigation and why so many people, including myself, still have questions.
Absolutely. Well, Jen, you've done amazing work digging in on this. I cannot wait to see what you and Andy come up with next week as you start diving into this. And we hope all of those watching this will join us as we retrace Micah Miller's steps on that fateful Saturday, April 27. I'm now going to bring in Andy Fancher. Andy was in Myrtle Beach for the first part of this week, as the Micah Miller story, again, was at its apex as reporters from all over the country were descending on Myrtle Beach to try to get the scoop on exactly what happened. We're joined now by Andy Fancher. Andy, tell us what you saw.
So what I saw here was a celebration of life, this beachside memorial for Micah Miller, simultaneous with John Paul Miller's memorial service at the church. So whether or not this was planned intentionally or not, that's not for me to say. But yes, we did attend that beachside memorial. We were the only media outlet that was cognizant enough to record the audio portion. That entire service is available on our website and online.
Excellent. What did you hear from those who, family members who cared about her? Was there anyone that stood out to you as you listened to what they said and how they memorialized her life?
Of course. I mean, of the handful of people who did speak, amid over 100 people who were present for this memorial service, I would say that her father certainly stuck out the most, talking about how he's had to really lean on faith in the ensuing days following her suicide as not to act out, to be irrational. And in fact, we have a clip of that, and we'll play that
now. Yeah, let's check it out. Alleged suicide, obviously.
Alleged
suicide. We'll stick with that for now. But yeah, let's watch this clip.
It's hard for me not to preface this without saying you're looking at the angriest dad in Myrtle Beach right now. And it has taken every bit of strength in me not to be angry without sinning. The Bible says, be angry, don't sin. Don't make a mistake that you will regret in your anger, in your emotion. So, by the grace of God, I stand here not crying my face off and not being somebody who feels defeated, because Micah is not defeated. She lives on.
So, Andy, you're also down there as this story, again, is breaking, reporters swarming all over the place, trying to get a hold of the key players in this story. Mm-hmm. Tell us sort of about kind of your take on as this story unfolded, your investigative efforts down there at the beach.
Of course. Well, I could tell you that at the beach, the friends and family made it abundantly clear they did not want to lean into this, as you mentioned, national hysteria regarding John Paul Miller. What is it? PJP, Pastor John Paul. So it was simply on the life of Micah Miller at this memorial service, not on any of this egregious things that PJP is being accused of. So in the wake of that, I mean, yes, I spoke with some people who were friends and family of Micah Miller, who rightfully so did not want to have a media circus at this time and did not agree to speak on camera at this time. Granted, that looks as though it will change in the near future. And then there were, of course, multiple efforts made to get a hold of Pastor John Paul Miller himself.
Mm-hmm. And I want to point out real quick, Pastor, if you're watching, this microphone is always open to you. Always. We have an open mic policy at this media outlet for all the subjects we cover, particularly those who find themselves at the center of a storm like this, criticisms and questions and red flags. But Andy, let me ask you this. You and Jen Wood are about to embark on a journey this coming week. Mm-hmm. We're going to be retracing Micah Miller's steps on that fateful Saturday, April 27. What are you looking for as this next level of our investigation kicks off? What sort of things are you going to be focused on that trip? What unanswered questions are you tracking? Where do you think this story's going to go?
Well, that's the thing. It doesn't seem as even those closest related to Micah have any idea where this is going to go next. We don't know where the pastor went while we were in town when he was supposedly served some papers at his doorside step, and we don't know what we're going to find out at the national park where she, as you emphasized, allegedly killed herself. But we do have some interviews already lined up. I'm just going to be a blocking force here. I'm just going to have a camera in hand with the microphones present. Jen Wood is going to be the powerhouse here. And of course, I will serve as again, some assistance there and getting a hold of some additional people that I made contact with in Myrtle Beach on my original trip. But we're just essentially going to contextualize those final steps and talk with some arguably key players along the way. Nice. This includes legal and some friends.
Nice, man. Well, I'll tell you what I love about the way you do this job, man, is always pushing back. You know, we hear all these rumors, we see all these conspiracy theories. Andy Fancher brings it all back to, hey, show me the receipts, prove it.
You know, which is why I think you saw my hesitation when you said the alleged suicide. I mean, it's confirmed twice over.
That's true. Medical examiner and the sheriff's. Obviously, there's some holes. Some initial holes that.
And you know, I'll push back on myself here and say that you know, law enforcement, as they have abundantly made clear time and time again across Lawrence, Neopath, the Upstate, Lowcountry, yeah, they make mistakes.
Absolutely.
So I will give you that much. But at this time, it is a twice confirmed suicide. We will see if that changes, though.
Absolutely. Well, we're certainly, like we said at the outset of this, open to all takes, and particularly you, Pastor Miller. Anytime you want to come on, Andy's ready to sit down with you. Right?
Well, yeah. I mean, that was a message that I had made abundantly clear in my written message that is my understanding was delivered to him. I had actually enforced what you just said to the messenger, which is that we have an open microphone policy, which means that if Micah's family wants to talk to us or if you want to talk to us, that outlet is open to you. So, yes, I had made that effort, and the offer, as you just said, it still stands.
And it always stands here at Fist News. Andy Fancher, can't wait to see what you and Jen come up with on this trip where you trace the final steps of Micah Miller. Can't wait to see it, man. So for the better part of the last 3 years, this media outlet has been focused on judicial reform, on fixing South Carolina's badly broken judicial branch of government. In fact, we've been a broken record on this issue. We've been calling out not only judges, but more importantly, the lawmakers who appoint them. That's right. Here in South Carolina, we're one of only two states in the entire country where the legislature, the lawmakers, specifically lawyer legislators, pick judges. And in fact, it's even worse here than it is in Virginia, the only other state where they do it this way, because here we've got a clique, a panel of lawyer legislators that screen these judges, ostensibly based on their merit, before passing them off to be voted on by their colleagues. The whole process is rigged, in other words. But here's the real problem. After they pick these judges, after they set their budgets, their salaries, then they go and argue cases in front of them. And we're supposed to believe that this process is fair? Well, guess what, folks? It's not fair. In fact, we've spent years documenting just how unfair it is. The Bowen Turner case, for example, a glaring example of a powerful lawyer legislator manipulating the system to get a positive outcome for their client. We see it with Minority Leader Todd Rutherford, again, the poster lawyer legislator for the inherent corruption in this system. We've called it out over and over and over again. And we've also pointed out the tragic consequences of the failure of the General Assembly to fix this broken system. Well, within the last year, we have seen a dramatic shift in momentum and a shift in public perception. For the first time, people have started citing this as one of their key issues when they look at who they're going to vote for or vote against. They've become aware of just how broken the system is and joined us in our efforts to try and fix it. We've seen solicitors step up. We've seen a small group of lawmakers step up. We've seen a growing public chorus and media chorus citing this as a key issue. So with all this wind behind the sails of the judicial reform movement, what has actually been accomplished? In the first year in which judicial reform was actually a priority, purportedly a priority, within the South Carolina General Assembly, what was actually accomplished? Guess what? Not a whole hell of a lot. In fact, as we film this, we're teetering between not a whole hell of a lot and absolutely nothing. To their credit, lawmakers did hold hearings on these bills. And to their credit, a small handful of lawmakers, led by Joe White out of Newberry, South Carolina, pushed for real reform. We even had one senator, Wes Clymer, hold up judicial elections demanding that lawmakers address this issue. Unfortunately, the bills that they put forward, folks, don't amount to anything even resembling the vicinity of the ballpark of the area code of real reform. Basically, they tinkered with some of the processes of this secretive screening panel, and they toyed with the composition of that panel. But at the end of the day, not only does the legislature still retain the majority of the appointments on that panel, but lawyer legislators are still allowed to serve on it. So the very root of the problem, one branch of government controlling the other, and oh, by the way, the powerful lawyer legislators profiting off of that control, neither one of those problems were fixed. The status quo held. And again, that's assuming one of these watered-down bills actually becomes law. Now, a year ago, I penned a column on FitzNews.com which detailed what a real reform of the system looks like, what a transformative change would be. Specifically, I talked about having governors make appointments. Sure, let the legislature confirm them just like they do at the federal level, but give the executive branch a voice in this process. More importantly, I proposed that after those appointments were made, every 2 years, judges face retention elections. Now, this is not a one candidate versus another situation. This would be a simple yes or no vote so that corrupt judges or judges who abuse their position, judges who routinely dole out terrible decisions that endanger public safety, that re-victimize victims, so that those judges can be voted out of office. And again, after that, it would be up to the governor to appoint a successor. That is what real reform looks like, one that gives the executive branch and the public a voice in the process. Now, lawmakers claimed they couldn't do that this year. They claimed that there wasn't sufficient political will to accomplish that. They claimed that doing that would be too hard because they would have to change the Constitution and get two-thirds votes in both chambers. They said it was too difficult, that they couldn't get it done. I want to remind you folks of something else that happened last year. We're talking about that column I wrote a year ago, talking about what needed to be done on this subject. Last year, in the span of 12 days, people, lawmakers wrote, introduced, passed, and got signed by the governor a $1.3 billion crony capitalist handout to an electric vehicle manufacturer, Scout Motors. Again, I don't know if you've been watching the EV industry lately, but I'm not bullish on it. I don't think you should be either. But either way, $1.3 billion of your money gone in 12 days. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the standard for legislative action. When they want to do something, they can do it. And they can get those two-thirds majorities that they claim they couldn't get for judicial reform. Now, as this issue moves forward, I want to tell you something. We are working with victims all across the country. In fact, I was emailing just this week with one who has been following our coverage all the way from the other side of the country. And here in South Carolina, a growing group of victims is thoroughly frustrated, not only by how broken the system is, but by this joke of an effort to change it. That's right, folks. What happened in the General Assembly this year? It's a travesty. It's a whitewash. And in fact, the ultimate embarrassment was when the leaders of the General Assembly, led by Merle Smith, put two ardent opponents of judicial reform on the committee that's supposed to negotiate the bill. I'm talking about Mike Kakaski, Leon Stavronakis, two individuals who have made their names in the legislature by attacking judicial reformers. These are the people that the House Speaker put on the panel. That tells you all you need to know about what they think of this issue. Again, if it's $1.3 billion for corporate cronies, no problem. They can get it done. But if it's protecting you, protecting those you care about, and upholding the integrity of our justice system, they can't be troubled to pass real reform. I make you this promise, folks. We're not going anywhere on this issue. We will never go anywhere on this issue. This microphone, which we have turned over to countless victims over the last few years, we will continue to do it. We will continue to share their stories, and we will continue to push for the accountability over this broken system that must come to pass if we are to ever, ever see the sort of reform that South Carolinians deserve. All right, that is a wrap for this week's edition of The Week in Review. Quick programming note, the retrial of Somerville, South Carolina jeweler Michael Colucci, another South Carolina story that garnered national headlines, that case has been continued. It was supposed to be held on May the 13th, this coming Monday, but we learned this week that that trial has been continued. As soon as we get a date, we'll keep you up to speed. A ton of other stories we covered this week, folks. There was a great update on an animal cruelty case out of the South Carolina upstate by Callie Lyons. She is digging deep on that story, holding the law enforcement folks who are linked to that story accountable for their conduct. Check that update out. Several other big stories that posted on the site, but obviously the Micah Miller saga dominated the headlines this past week. On that note, as I mentioned earlier in the show, be sure to keep it tuned to FitzNews.com this week as our team follows the steps of Micah Miller on her last day. Keep it tuned to FitzNews. Thanks for watching the show, and we'll check you next time on The Week in Review.